Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have.
WGN. Welcome into Legal Face Off here. WGN Radio, WGNRadio.com. The Legal Eagles are here. The first episode of May. Rich Linkoff, Tina Martini. My name is Sam Panionovich, and Ben Anderson is behind the glass. We've got several topics to get to. Corporate board diversity. We've got parent dress codes. We've got DCFS. And, of course, the legal grab bag at the end of the show. But we begin talking about congressional subpoenas to the president, Donald Trump. And to discuss more, Josh Chaffetz from the Cornell Law School joining us now, professor of law. Professor, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me.
Professor, Trump has filed two lawsuits asking courts to invalidate the House Democrat subpoenas, which, of course, call for a variety of financial documents. This seems to be the first time that a sitting president has responded to a congressional inquiry by suing a member of Congress. These are certainly interesting times. You study the relationship between Congress and the executive branch. How likely is it for Trump to win this lawsuit?
I think it's incredibly unlikely that Trump wins this lawsuit. The houses of Congress have incredibly broad oversight powers. They have incredibly expansive powers to compel documents, both from other parts of the government and from private citizens. And it's worth noting that Trump suing here is suing in his capacity as a private citizen in both of those cases. So this doesn't even really implicate executive power concerns. It's simply a question of whether Congress has the right, or House of Congress has the right, to compel documents in the service of its oversight capacity.
And to that point,
the answer is clearly that it does.
I'm sorry. Yeah. And to that point, he has also asserted executive privilege over releasing the entirety of the unredacted version of the Mueller report. Right. So that is in his capacity as president.
Right, and that's separate from the accounting and the Deutsche Bank subpoenas. I think in that case too, he's got an incredibly weak case. Executive privilege is a fairly tightly constrained doctrine, and something like a special prosecutor's report on potential criminal activity surrounding the presidential election simply isn't the sort of thing that would normally fall within executive privilege. But I should say, I'm not sure that Trump's goal in any of these cases is to actually win the claim at the end of the day. By going to court on all of these, he makes sure that this all takes quite a bit of time. And his goal really might just be to draw this out, to try to run out the clock, to try to sort of get the public to get bored with all of this.
So, Professor, what about the House subpoenas to Attorney General Barr to testify, which he's ignored? And he's been found in contempt. How successful will the House be in enforcing the subpoena?
Well, it depends how the House goes about trying to enforce it. So in recent decades, the House has generally gone to the courts to try to enforce its contempt citations. The first time it ever did that was in Watergate. So it's only something it's been doing for about 50 years, but did it during sort of very prominent clashes with the executive branch during both the George W. Bush and the Obama administrations. At the end of the day, the House usually wins in court. The problem is it takes forever. So it took them almost 6 years to get the information that they wanted from Eric Holder. And by that time, Eric Holder was no longer attorney general and Barack Obama was no longer president. So if they go to court, they might win on the merits in a sort of legal sense, but they might lose in terms of what they're actually trying to do, which is oversee the Trump administration. I think they would be much better served by using their sort of distinctly congressional tools, using things like the power of the purse, potentially the publicity that comes with impeachment proceedings or something like that, as a way of putting political pressure on the White House and on the Justice Department.
So you don't believe it sounds like that there will actually be the sergeant at arms going to the Department of the Treasury or going to the Department of Justice and literally walking in and, you know, pulling Mnuchin or Barr into the House of Congress, and there happens to be a little jail in there too. You don't think that's likely to happen, it sounds like. And let's assume that that somehow happened. Don't you think that would be a huge win politically for Trump? I mean, I think to your point, and which I agree with, you know, all of this, the more the House and the more the Democrats push this issue that I think many people perceive as being dead and closed, the more it plays into Trump's political hand, which is, look what the Democrats are continuing to, you know, belabor even while I'm trying to focus on what's important, which is the economy, national defense, etc.
Well, to your first point, I don't think it's likely that the House will send its sergeant at arms out in that way, but it does have the power to do that. But as I say, I don't think they will. But I don't think that the House is necessarily going to lose if this confrontation becomes increasingly high stakes. I think essentially what we're in now is a battle for the hearts and minds of the public, and there's a question about sort of how this gets publicly framed. The House wants to frame this around, especially at this point, around the White House's stonewalling all requests for information, right? That this is something that previous White Houses of both parties have not done. They've worked with Congress, even when Congress was controlled by the other party. Even when Congress made some information requests that they didn't like, they've at least continued to give them information on other topics. So the Trump administration refusing to hand over anything on any topic at this point is a relatively new situation. And I think the House Democrats are going to try to make the case to the public that this justifies increased assertiveness on their part as well. And whether they succeed or not, I think is something we're just going to have to wait and see. We're going to have to wait and see how it plays out. But I'm not at all convinced that this necessarily plays into the White House's hands.
Last question. Will the recent New York Times reveal of Trump's tax returns in the 90s, revealing this massive loss, and you know they called him the person who had the biggest loss in during that period in taxpaying history. Do you think that will make it more likely or less likely that he will comply with the subpoena, at least for his financial documents?
Well, I think a lot of people who had been paying attention figured that his tax returns were going to show that he was nowhere near the businessman that he's always presented himself as. So I'm not sure it makes it any more or less likely. I do think that the more of this that comes out, the more it sort of dents his aura as this sort of financial genius. And so I think it partially explains why he's so invested in keeping these things public. I think also the other thing that it plays into is, you know, we see how many years he didn't pay any taxes at all. And it plays into a narrative about the way that sort of ultra wealthy people like Trump managed to manipulate the tax system, sort of living really opulent lifestyles while not paying anything at all into the Treasury. And that, I think, is a point that a lot of Democrats are sort of, especially Democratic presidential contenders, are well placed to sort of hammer home with the public.
It's great stuff. Professor Josh Chaffetz from the Cornell Law School, thank you so much for your insight, Professor, and we hope to do it again soon.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crain Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
You can follow the show, Legal Face Off, on Facebook and Twitter. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can rate, review, and share with a friend. Rich Lenkoff, Tina Martini here at the WGN Radio Studios. Joining us now on the phones, State Representative Anna Moeller from Illinois' 43rd District to talk about DCFS and the very, very tragic A.J. Friend case. Representative, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
On Tuesday, the Illinois Auditor General released a review of the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services investigative practices from 2015 to 2017. He found that 102 children, or 15.5%, that they looked into that died during that time frame had previous contact with DCFS. What's going on? What's going wrong with DCFS, Representative?
we had a hearing yesterday with the Office of the Inspector General for DCFS, and it's actually worse. We had 112 children die since last July. There were 9 children who died in the last 9, like, since the end of April, who were in DCFS in contact, or where DCFS had been in contact with the family. So, yes, we have a tremendous and very tragic situation on our hands with DCFS. And we've created a special caucus within the legislature, within the House, to focus attention on what is going on at DCFS and what we can do to solve this problem and make this agency a functional agency that's actually protecting children in our state.
So high level, what are the pressure points with DCFS? I mean, I think, you know, one that immediately comes to mind is the fact that there may not be enough caseworkers. I think that there have been a number that have been hired on recently. What are the other pressure points here?
Well, that is a big issue. We know that they don't have enough caseworkers, and the caseworkers are handling too many cases in violation of federal consent decrees, and obviously not able to provide the appropriate oversight and attention that's necessary to investigate these cases. So we do need more resources within the agency. The budget impasse took a huge toll on the department, and so we have a lot of recovering to do from that. But in addition to ensuring that we have enough people investigating these cases, we also need to make sure that the policies that are in place are appropriate and that the training that these caseworkers are receiving is appropriate. Referring back to the Auditor General report, some of that, those areas are also deficient. When a caseworker visits with a family or interviews a child, they conduct a safety assessment. And one of the findings of the Auditor General is that the training on conducting these safety assessments and using the forms that the department has put together for these safety assessments was inadequate. And a lot of caseworkers had not been trained on how to fill out the documentation or conduct these assessments appropriately. We have a lot of turnover within the department because of the caseloads and because of the challenges. 85% of the work that's actually done in investigating these cases is done by nonprofit organizations within communities to do the work for DCFS. And these workers are paid a relatively low wage. And so training, staffing, adequately funding programs that, you know, agencies that hire these workers, all of those issues are part of, I think, what has led to this, you know, this huge problem that we see at the department.
So, and, Representative, if I could just jump in. So, I mean, speaking about the particular case involving AJ Friend that obviously has garnered all this attention, and, you know, for our listeners who maybe haven't followed the story, AJ Friend, 5-year-old boy who was found wrapped in plastic in a shallow grave near Woodstock, Illinois, 3 or 4 weeks ago. His parents have been charged with murder. The disturbing part, and to the point that you're raising, is records show that AJ Friend had told an ER doctor that he had been beaten with a belt. This was something that a DCFS administrator heard about, but yet blamed on a playful family dog, closed the complaint only 4 months before he died. You know, I get it. We all get it. And we all understand that these people are underpaid and overworked and there's not enough. And, you know, our state budget is a mess and our financial situation is a mess. But, you know, this has got to be fixed. This can't happen again. This is nuts.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there are more cases like AJ's where there were clear signs in looking back and reviewing the cases, clear signs of abuse, but their cases were considered unfounded. And And that's something that we're really struggling to find out how that could happen, how a caseworker could be could look at the bruises and the welts and cuts on the on these children's bodies and not consider that an indicator of abuse. It's baffling. It's confounding. It's horrible. And these are the cases that we're looking at and we're asking questions about. And one of the areas and one of the policies that I've raised is the fact that, you know, as a as an agency and this is actually a national posture towards dealing with child abuse and child neglect is or children who are at risk is this policy of family reunification and keeping families intact. Which is a policy that came out of prior history where children were removed from families at a much higher rate. And I, in my opinion, and this is something that we're, you know, I want to look more into and further investigate, is has the pendulum swung too far where we're leaving children in dangerous homes with parents because there is an incentive or an overall policy goal of leaving, of keeping families intact. And, you know, certainly we want to make sure that where a child is going to be safe and where families can be stabilized and assisted through wraparound services or, you know, things, resources that we can provide as a state, we want to do that. But when a child is going to be at risk of further abuse or even death, that child is taken out of that environment, even if it means taking them away from their parents. And so when, in looking at these cases, that's something that we're also going to be talking to the department about and talking to advocates who work with children in these situations about, you know, moving away from this. The ultimate policy goal is keeping children with their parents. And we introduced a bill this week that starts to get at that, where we are requiring the department to create neutral policies that don't incentivize leaving children with their parents if it's not in their best interest. And right, we've discovered over the past, you know, couple of weeks that the department did have incentives in place to keep families together, and I don't know if that's part of what led to the tragedies that we've, you know, learned about with AJ and other children who've been killed in the last year, but I suspect that may be part of it.
She is Representative Anna Moeller, Illinois' 43rd District Representative, a Democrat based out of Elgin. Representative, thank you so much for your time here on Legal Faceoff.
Thank you. Thank you for your interest in this important issue.
We all know the legal world is complex and high-pressured. There's no room for error. That's why judges and attorneys across Chicagoland have trusted the expert court reporters at McCorkle Litigation Services since 1948. McCorkle Litigation Services has accurately recorded every word from thousands of legal proceedings. McCorkle Litigation Services provides the legal community with peace of mind, transcribing testimony and depositions that can be used reliably by jurors, judges, and attorneys. For all of your legal support needs, contact McCorkle Litigation Services online at McCorkleLitigation.com.
Welcome back to Legal Faceoff. Legal Eagles are here. Rich Lankoff and Tina Martini. My name is Sam Panionovich. We go back out to the phones and bring in Professor Todd Henderson, who's the Michael J. Marks Professor of Law at the University of Chicago Law School. Also the author of the forthcoming book, The Trust Revolution, which you can get coming soon, where you can get all of your books. That's for sure. Todd Henderson, welcome to the show.
Be here. Thanks for having me.
So, Professor, the Illinois House recently passed House Bill 3394 that requires public companies, which are headquartered in Illinois, to have at least one woman, one Latino, and one African-American on their corporate boards. As we've all seen in the headlines, the bill is met with a lot of controversy and became a rather heated debate along party lines. What are the latest statistics regarding regarding diversity on corporate boards or lack thereof? And why is achieving diversity, why has it been so difficult in this context over the past few years?
So the numbers are getting better from the perspective of the people who are advocating for more diverse corporate boards along racial, ethnic lines. I think there's other dimensions of diversity that we probably will, we could talk about and we'll hear about, but the numbers have gotten better. I think women and minorities now are making up something like 40% of corporate directors. That's obviously less than their percentages in terms of the population, but there's been some improvement, and African Americans, I think, are specifically that group is pushing 7%. I don't have the numbers off the top of my head with Hispanics, and of course, we could go through lots of other categories, Asian Americans, LGBT people, and so forth, and I think that slicing and dicing raises its own issues. There's been some progress. Now, as to the question of why there are these numbers are not representative of the population as a whole, there's lots of reasons, but I think it would be naive to deny that there has been a history of subjugation and discrimination. Women only recently entered the workforce on relative terms. African Americans and others kept from elite positions through lack of educational opportunities and other reasons. And I think that historical discrimination is still echoing in modern times.
All right. You think, Professor, this won't hold much? This won't be upheld by the courts. Why do you think that?
Well, if there is a challenge to the statute, which I suspect there will be, it's clearly illegal for two reasons. The first one has to do with sort of corporate law and the way we do corporate law in the United States, and the other one has to do with sort of race and discrimination law. So quickly on the first one, corporate law in this country, and it's been this way for a long time, over a century, has been a state-based system. And the state that is relevant is not the headquarters state, but the state where the company chooses to incorporate. So let's take Boeing. They're headquartered here in Chicago. They're a Delaware corporation. So they have chosen, as a choice of law, to use Delaware as their law. And the way the Supreme Court has thought of this is that the internal affairs of Boeing, how they run their board and the corporate governance and the laws that govern the internal matters of how Boeing operates, those are set by the legislature of Delaware, not by Illinois or any of the other states. And the primary reason for that is it would just create either mass confusion or impossible situations. So one state could have one set of rules for boards, another state could have another set of rules. A Washington state, where Boeing has tons of operations, could have one set of requirements. Illinois, where their headquarters is, could have another. Delaware could have a third. Mississippi, where they sell planes, could have another one. And that would just create an impossible situation. There can only be one board of directors. So Illinois is certainly free as a corporate law matter to regulate corporations that are incorporated under Illinois law. That's not Boeing or the companies, most of the companies that have their headquarters here. Now, the reason they didn't do that approach is because very few companies are incorporated in Illinois, because Illinois doesn't have really great corporate law. The other issue, and so I think that's a slam dunk. The other issue, which I think is a little harder, is the discrimination side of things. The Supreme Court has used the Equal Protection Clause. There's also some federal statutes that may be at play to prohibit specific racial quotas or ethnic quotas. They've allowed things like considering race or ethnicity in college admissions, for instance, but even those cases have pretty categorically said companies can't use quotas. And so I think an Illinois statute requiring Boeing to have a Hispanic, black, women, whatever the categories are, I think that would, especially under the current court, run afoul of its equal protection jurisprudence just as a discrimination matter. So even if Illinois wanted to apply this law just to Illinois incorporated companies, I think they would have a hard time.
So what do you think is the ultimate solution, though? Say for, you know, like, let's pretend for a moment that this is not law, that it ultimately doesn't stand in Illinois. How do you think we can get where we need to get, and what the spirit of the bill is? How do we get there short of a bill like this?
That's a great question. And I would just say, first of all, I think there are people who, you know, use the term we need to get. I mean, I think there are people who would argue that we don't necessarily need to get anywhere in terms of racial discrimination in the boardroom. You know, the real problem is solving the underlying access problems I mentioned, the historical discrimination, improving educational opportunities for everybody, starting in, you know, primary school and so forth, that would be a better use of social resources. So I think people could make that argument. You know, why are we focused on boards of directors? You know, we want the best people to run corporations, and we want everybody to have the opportunity to get there. You know, we don't need to sort of solve that particular problem. But I could see the other side of it. So I just say, like, there is a debate there. In terms of if you have as your goal diversifying the boardroom, you know, the way to do it is the good old-fashioned American way, which is don't try to legislate it. Use your power to convince companies it's a good idea. All of us are consumers of Boeing products or John Deere products or McDonald's products. Many of us are shareholders, if you don't own shares directly, your pension fund, your 401k, they are investors in these things. And so American consumers and American shareholders, American workers, those people all have a voice. And corporate law specifically, and just, you know, our society generally, gives those people the opportunity to scream and let it be heard that they want changes. You know, I'll note some big institutional investors. You know, Larry Fink at BlackRock is an example. The California pension system is another example. Illinois has a very big pension system, and they invest. They could say, look, we're going to, as shareholders who own these corporations, who elect boards of directors, we're going to make it a priority that we're going to have these particular criteria, whether it's racial, ethnic, gender identity, whatever those things are. And so there's nothing wrong with that, in voicing your opinions as a shareholder. That's a much better approach, using the market in that way, in my personal opinion, than the trying to legislate it, even assuming the legislation was not unconstitutional, which I think it is.
That is Professor Todd Henderson, Michael J. Marks Professor of Law at the University of Chicago Law School. And again, the book coming out soon, The Trust Revolution, Where All Books Are Found. Professor, thank you so much for your time.
That was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Rich Lenkoff is an insurance defense attorney with Bryce Downey & Lenkoff. Rich is consistently recognized by clients for his outstanding litigation results. In 2015, Target named him their top outside litigation attorney in the country. Rich has received a number of industry accolades, including Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 through 2018 and Leading Lawyer from 2012 through 2018, designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, including serving on the Lincoln Park High School Local School Council, the Advisory Board of Legal Prep Charter Academy, and the Board of Visitors for the Northern Illinois University College of Law. In addition to his full-time legal practice, Rich is a producer with credits, including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring former President Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka, and Renegades, a live show production at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon. In addition to co-hosting Legal Faceoff since 2013, Rich is the legal analyst for several WGN shows, including The Bill and Wendy Show and Patty Vasquez with Andrea Darlis. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional liability, business transactions, construction law, and intellectual property. For more information about Rich and Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, please visit bdlfirm.com.
We have a jam-packed studio here for the legal grab bag. Rich Lenkoff, Tina Martini. My name is Sam Panionovich. Of
Packed.
Course, you have Bennett Wakenight, who's the executive producer of Business Content, the opening bell and the business lunch.
Is that your real last name, by the way?
That is my real last name.
Wow.
Yeah. That's a cool name.
It's a good radio last name.
Yeah, it's not a bad last name.
Rich thought you were lying.
Yeah, I thought it was your late night producer name.
That was one of my radio shows in college, Late Night with Wakenight.
So nice.
Had to play
like
off
that.
The name at least once.
That's actually very, very good. And then Lindsay Strom, who is an attorney at Strom & Associates, joining us in the studio. Hello.
Hi.
Is that your real name?
Thanks for having me. You know that's my real name.
Yes.
Now, Rich said you guys go way back, though. Can you give a quick backstory?
Tell all the secrets.
Yeah, I'll tell all the goods. So I started working first for Rich. I work with my father currently. But we started in 2008.
I was her original father figure.
Yeah,
before
he's
her real dad.
And I started working at Bryce Downey. Rich taught me everything and correct that will.
Notice how she left
she
out
forgot the
Lenkoff.
Most important part of that law firm name. That's okay. I see.
Rich Lenkoff, my there former boss, who also almost fired me.
Oh my God. That's
Seriously, a whole
show in and of itself.
Oh my God.
Well, no. He just, you know.
The other story is I almost fire every attorney every day. So that's just.
No, but there's much love now. We're super tight.
Yeah, for the word is now.
There you go.
So our first topic, and we have several topics here. The first topic involves a shooter's bartender being arrested.
Yeah, there was an arrest this week of a female bartender named Lindsay Glass in Plano, Texas. She served, the allegation goes that she overserved a patron. He ended up shooting, committing the worst crime actually in Plano history, Plano, Texas. He shot seven people, killed seven people, after drinking at this bar. The allegation is that, she overserved him. He was four times over the legal limit. When he left the bar, and a big part of the case involves this text that this woman sent where she says, Spencer has a big knife on the bar and is spinning it and just asked for his tab and said, I have to go do some dirty work. There's a scared emoji on that?
Concerned emoji.
Concerned emoji.
Say.
And then she says, psycho. So
with many O's.
Many O's. The allegation is that even though he was drunk, this was a highly and carefully planned assault. He came with a gun, a rifle, and a knife. Again, the knife that he was twirling on the bar. So the police have arrested her and charged her with being involved in this crime. Notably, there was a civil suit that the family filed against the bar that was dropped. But what do we think? I mean, there's dram shop laws in every state. Dram shop basically says that if you are serving someone and they then go out and commit a crime or get into a car accident and you can show that the intoxication was a factor, then you might be liable as the bartender, as the bar owner, etc. So this is kind of a novel case. You don't see this one too often involving, you know, a shooting spree.
Right.
What do you guys think? Tina, should the woman face some jail time?
Well, I have to say, you know, the dram shop acts and laws exist for a reason, but there was more going on here than that. I mean, she knew he was exhibiting very erratic behavior, dangerous behavior. Like, why didn't she step in and intervene? I don't understand that.
Yeah. Well,
at all. I mean, first of all, usually when people are that intoxicated, you can tell, but he's spinning a knife on the bar. I mean, she didn't think maybe this guy shouldn't be, you know.
Right. So according to her attorney, he says that when she became suspicious of this patron who ended up committing the crime, she contacted her manager. And then when her manager didn't resolve the issue, she actually left the bar and followed him and called 911. He said that she never expected him to commit this act. But again, to your point, she didn't quite do enough and she didn't stop serving him.
Right. Right? She kept serving him. He was four times over the legal limit.
The thing to do would be to stop giving this guy shots, right? So.
Yeah. I think part of it is that, you know, clearly she shouldn't have continued to serve him. That's first and foremost. However, playing devil's advocate, which I usually like to do.
Or plaintiff's lawyer.
Well, okay. Sure. We'll go with that. I just think, you know, what about the owner of the bar who said not to call the police? I feel like more of the blame should fall on him and the bar itself than her necessarily, only because if she did go to him and say, this is what should happen, and then he discouraged her from doing it, it kind of puts more of the blame on him. Why didn't he do it? I do think, you know, yes, she shouldn't have served him, but as I was reading this story, what really stuck out to me is that he seemed to already have the thought in his mind that he was going to do this. He had the malice aforethought. He had the guns and everything ready. He knew that he was going to do it, I think, before he even walked into that
bar. Clearly she didn't give him the idea. But Bennett, the law we're talking about in Texas is called the sale of certain persons offense. Someone is guilty of violating that if they negligently sell an alcoholic beverage to a habitual drunkard or an intoxicated or insane person. What do you think?
I see I have very little legal knowledge, you know, just for foresight, but I definitely see where it's coming, where the blame could be put on her, especially for that, if there was that law set in place right then and there. But from an everyday perspective, I think there should have been much more owner intervention or bouncer intervention of saying, first off, there's a guy with a weapon in this bar.
That's scary enough.
Yeah, that should be alone, you know, if it's a big enough
knife.
It is
Texas,
like she said.
By the way.
I did then think of it then.
Right.
This is Texas. Hold on. Let's take a step back. So that's another factor. But I definitely see, even if the text message alone was the only effort that the bartender said, this is my effort of reaching out to my boss saying this is my concern about a patron, I think that should have been, all right, there should be more people involved in trying to resolve this. And it seemed like there wasn't. And then her going further, saying, I'm leaving the bar, I'm going to try to resolve this, and then I'm going to call the cops. I think she did as, aside from not serving him and saying, I'm cutting you off, she did as much as she could have done.
Second story involves former Lakers coach and current Sacramento Kings coach Luke Walton, who is now rich in some hot water, to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, just after he took the head coaching job with the Kings, it seems like this story came out. Kelly Tennant alleges in a lawsuit that Luke Walton assaulted her inside a hotel when he was coach of the Golden State Warriors back in 2016. Her lawsuit goes into some detail about him forcing kisses on her neck, face, and chest. He says that he held her, or she says that he held her down and groped her. He has denied that. He's actually been very vocal in saying this is, an attempt to extort him. But, you know, obviously troubling allegations against someone who, until now, we haven't heard anything like this against him. And in the wake of all of the, you know, other things we've heard against both athletes and celebrities in the news lately, obviously very disturbing. The Kings have launched an internal investigation, as has the NBA. But for now, her lawsuit is going forward. Folks, thoughts? You cover the NBA, Sam, of course, for years.
Yeah. Thanks for throwing me on the spot first. Look, I mean, you have to do your
due diligence.
Luke Walton
hasn't been the subject of any rumors in the past, has he?
He has not, but that doesn't really mean much going forward, right? I mean, we have to do our, you know, homework here and make sure that everything is lining up. And you know, you hate to judge. I hate to jump to any judgment, right? I'm in a room full of attorneys, so I always want to be sure of what I'm saying. But I think, you know, you have to hear all parties before we do anything. I mean, I'm sure there are some, Tina, that are already jumping to judgment and painting them red already, but
right.
Until we know more, it's hard to really pontificate on it, right?
Well, I mean, I'd say, yeah, especially in the context of Me Too, you know, it lends itself to making this conversation take on a whole different sort of a framework. But I agree with you, Sam, that we need to do our homework here, need to get the results of the investigation before we can say he's guilty.
Yeah, 100%. I agree. I mean, look, especially in the world of celebrity and high profile people, you know, there's always going to be people who are going to come out with stories like this. It happens so often that we can't tell what's real and what's fiction anymore. We just kind of have to wait to see how this all plays out and what evidence there is from either party to really ultimately someone will make a decision on this and seal his fate. But it's hard to say right now when you don't have all of the information.
I think from a consumer perspective of love the NBA, been following all these stories, obviously from the news perspective as well. But if there is the connection that he may have been, in addition to him being a bad, you know, coach at the Lakers, if there was a connection to this, might have also added into the reason of the firing from the Lakers. If that later comes out, obviously can't say yet. Like we said, have to have all the facts, but
well, and to that point, it makes you question the due diligence on the part of the Kings in hiring this guy. I mean, I guess it could be that their investigation did not reveal it, but you would think at this point in our lives, given how much notoriety these stories get, rightfully so, and how pervasive this issue is, especially in sports, especially in the NBA, you would think the Kings would have, you know, made absolutely clear that any hire would have zero issues in their past. Yet, you know, this comes forward. I don't know if teams don't take it seriously or they just are so enamored with someone that they think this is not going to come out. I mean, Sam, you know these issues. Why wouldn't the Kings find this out and, you know, deal with it before they would hire a high-profile guy like Luke Walton?
Sports teams are known to be tone-deaf. I mean, how many NFL teams? I mean,
there's
Kareem Hunt. Kareem Hunt, did you see the footage of what Kareem Hunt did?
Still gets a job.
The Browns are like, hey, well, that was in the past. I mean, sports teams are all about the bottom line, they're about winning games and about making money.
Yeah.
And that's the reality of it. It's sad. My thing is this. I see the details on the story here. We've got it up on Fox News, the details about what he allegedly did. But I don't know. Maybe it's me. When I see the letters TMZ on the report, I'm always like, I don't know. I'm always reserving judgment for somebody else. Maybe I'm by myself on that one. I don't know.
I don't know. I feel like TMZ, they normally come through. I feel like they normally
thank God
do.
For TMZ. TMZ
the pros and cons
some good
of
stuff.
TMZ.
TMZ does get some good stuff, even though...
they do.
You know, some of their stories may be questionable, but they get, especially in sports, I mean, they're probably one of the leaders in getting some of these sports stories.
The thing with sports is, you know, they're always going to look the other way, unless it's something
the bottom
that's
line, right?
Super out there. Everybody knows it. Everybody saw, you know, a tape of domestic violence in an elevator or something like that. They're going to try and bury it. And I think that's possibly what happened here. Maybe it was just buried. No one knew.
Pretty tone deaf.
Third topic involves a father and a son at a law firm in South Carolina. There's an issue, Tina, between George Sink Sr. and George Sink Jr.
Yes, it's very unfortunate.
Such a great name. You would want to use it so many times.
Sink and Sink.
Well, I wouldn't go using it, Rich. It's not your name.
No.
But anyway, so there is this law firm in South Carolina. It's a personal injury firm, and George Sink Sr. started it, and his son, Jr., had joined him originally as a marketing intern, and then he decided to go to law school, joined as a lawyer. And in a very awkward situation, I'm sure, his father terminated his employment with the firm less than a year later. The son then decided to go out and start his own firm called George Sink II Law Firm. And his father sued him, claiming that his son's use of the Sink name constitutes trademark infringement and unfair competition and all the things that us trademark lawyers love to throw into a complaint. So what's interesting is that the son says that he feels like his father is trying to deprive him of use of his name. I, as the trademark lawyer here, can tell you that what his father is doing is perfectly within the law, and I would side with the father here.
But wait, could we have picked a better guest for the story?
I was just gonna say Strom Jr. When I read this, I was like, wow.
Wait till Neil Strom slaps you.
I can't imagine my father ever doing anything like this. I mean, it takes a special kind of person to do something like this to your child.
He got fired. I think that kind of sets the tone for this, doesn't it?
I'd love to know the reason behind the firing. None of that is disclosed in this article. I would love to know that, but still, you know, I understand where the father's coming from. Don't get me wrong. I get his point. However, you know, the child is a baby. They don't pick their own name. That's given to them. So what is he supposed to do? Granted, yes, there's plenty of other types of things you could do. Sink Law Firm, PC, or whatever. You could change it up. But
I think he's got to take Sink out of there.
But how? How could you do that? That's his name. So, you know, I work with my father and, you know, we'll continue to work together. I've been working with him for 9 years because remember, I worked for Rich before that. And I cannot imagine my father suing me over the name. It's really devastating, honestly. I get where the father is coming from, but I think as a father and son, this shouldn't happen.
It's pretty unfortunate. I mean, I don't think I could add much aside from that. It seems like this is a deeper rooted issue this is my opportunity.
Wait a second.
Put it on
all
paper in the law.
Intellectual property knows no emotion. It has no connection to father-son relationships. It's based on protecting the brand.
It's absolutely.
He built
father,
up a brand.
He built up equity in that. It is a brand. It is a trademark. Use of the name Sink in connection with legal services. He's not telling his son he can't use his name, you know, to call himself, you know, George Sink. He's just saying you can't use it. You can't put the name on the door for a law firm.
But you better shouldn't use Sink. So what's he going to do?
Pipe and drain.
Call it Apex Law Firm.
You better be nice to Neil, Lindsay, is all I got to say.
Yeah, exactly.
No lawsuits between Neil and Lindsay?
Like, no. No lawsuits.
Is it hard? Is it hard working with, because my brother's a lawyer. Absolutely. I worked with him for a couple summers. And there's
and
a reason.
And then you fired him.
No, there's a reason why we're now
right.
about 1,500 miles apart in our legal careers.
No, absolutely.
Is it hard? Like, what are the dynamics of working with a relative in a law firm? That's a good, that would be a whole show, I think. Yeah.
Well, David and I worked together, but we weren't married then.
Yeah. And you're not really, I mean, you're relatives by marriage. You know, yeah. It's different.
We're relatives by marriage.
No, you're not relatives. Tell us.
You know, you kind of know each other because you're married to each other.
Tell us the dynamics there.
As I say to most people who ask me, what's it like working with your dad? I say, there's good days and bad days, because there are. You know, we're people, we're humans, we have emotions, and even though he's my father, there's days I want to kill him, and there's days he wants to kill me.
Well, and it's even a little bit more bizarre, because you work with your mom, too.
Yeah. So my mom's in the office 3 days a week, doing the payroll and some of the other stuff, such as, you know, office expenses, ordering things, all the settlement checks. So, yeah, it's tough for me. You know, I'm not that young. I'm young, but I'm not that young. And so being with my parents on a consistent basis is tough. I'm lucky that my dad gives me a lot of autonomy. He trusts me, first and foremost, which is a very important part of what we do. And he knows that I can handle situations. I don't need him to be supervising me all the time. But we definitely clash on certain things.
What's your first memory of going to the office or doing something legal, professional with your dad?
Oh, well, that was even before I was a lawyer. Yeah. He took me around the commission and was like, here, this is what I do. And I got to meet all these different people and see what it's like.
And you were hooked.
Lo and behold, that's where I spend most of my time now.
All right.
Our next topic involves Clint Eastwood. I'll just say this. Get off my lawsuit. A lawsuit.
I knew someone was going to do that.
With our friend Clint Eastwood.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I don't know. This is just one where I'm like, really, really, why?
Well, you know, everybody's got to sue somebody at some point.
I mean, he's just an investor. He's got no standing.
You're stealing my story, lady.
sorry.
She feels really comfortable. I like that. Two topics in and jumping in.
Legal Face-Off with Lindsay Strong. New host.
Sorry. Go ahead.
So this came about. Clint Eastwood invested in the research of a particular doctor. His name was Harry Demopoulos back a couple of years ago. It was research involving a supplement. And unfortunately, the doctor suffered a stroke in 2016, and Molecular Defenses Corporation ended up, as Clint Eastwood characterized it, swooping in and had the patents and the rights to the patents transferred
Everyone
from the doctor.
Everyone swoops in, by the way, for Clint Eastwood. He's like 112.
Yeah.
He considers any movement swooping, but go ahead.
Yeah, swooping. So Eastwood ended up suing Molecular Defenses Corporation and its chief executive officer, claiming that they swindled him out of the patents. And unfortunately for Clint, the judge found for Molecular Defenses Corporation, claiming that he doesn't have standing to bring the claims because he is not an owner of the patents that are at issue. And the judge suggested that had he gone to state court first and gotten a verdict on conversion, you know, demonstrating that this company and Davis had actually caused the wrongful conversion of the patent, then if he had been successful on that, he would then be able to go into court. And
I know what you're thinking. Was it five bullets or six? Well, do you feel lucky, punk? By the way, my Clint Eastwood is not that far away from my Reagan. Well, there you go again.
Slight changes, I could tell.
Just a little, yeah. What do we think? What do we think of this? Standing or no standing? And by the way, no listener to our show is more fascinated by a concept than legal standing. That's so interesting.
Well, standing's very important.
Yeah,
it is the bedrock of the law.
I'm sure our listeners are loving the standing conversation. So what do we think?
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, standing?
No, he's got no standing.
Bennett?
Yeah, I think this is a last-ditch effort. He may be playing the character card a bit and saying, I'm just an old man. I'm just trying to invest and make some money. What happened here?
My money's gone.
I'm old.
You don't think we're just going to let you walk out of here, do you? Who is we, sucker? Smith and Wesson and me? That's from Sudden Impact. Favorite Clint Eastwood movie, Sam, come
Space
on.
Space Cowboy.
Yeah, Space Cowboy. You knew I was coming with that.
Yes.
Favorite Clint Eastwood movie, friends?
Oh, God, there's
Tina?
So many.
Yeah, Lindsay?
Bennett?
It's
got
to be Good, Bad, and the Ugly.
Oh.
The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Yeah, I was going to say any spaghetti western he's been in is good.
I love me some Every Which Way But Loose. You know, any movie that co-stars an orangutan is right in my wheelhouse. Right there.
Oh, God.
How about the episode? Wasn't he in an episode of Mr. Ed? Didn't Clint Eastwood meet Mr. Ed?
He's what? Been in like every. He was on TV
Are
for like
serious?
Years before.
Yeah. That's insane.
Go ahead. Make
okay.
my day.
Isn't he like 95? No, seriously.
I look it up. He is 88 years young.
Mm-hmm.
Hasn't still kicking.
Well, he's a very prolific director. Just directed The Mule. Did you see The Mule?
Yeah.
Good
yeah.
movie. Starred and directed in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Bennett Wakenight's favorite YouTube star, Jake Paul, mm-hmm. has had a problem. You didn't go to this party, did you, by the way?
No, got the invite, couldn't make the plane. Nope, wasn't there.
Who wants to take this one? Jake Paul's house party gone south.
Yeah, Jake Paul, who's described in one press release as a prankster. It's a good way to go around life. He had a big rager in his L.A. mansion in Calabasas, and authorities, the L.A. County Sheriff's Department, is now investigating reports that partygoers had their drinks spiked. There was one allegation that girls were half naked and unable to walk or talk. Some ended up in the hospital with some other girls who alleged that they were drugged and that they were incoherent. So the prankster might be in legal trouble.
What a shocker.
Yeah.
My
this
first
Lindsay, one,
big,
I mean, if the allegations are true that yeah. he was drugging people at his party, he should be in legal trouble.
Not great. Big Jake Paul fans, are we?
I don't even know who this is. I got to be honest.
Yeah.
I've never heard of him.
No?
No.
Bennett knows all
I'm
about
I'm a sucker
him.
For a little bit of pop culture here. And yeah. this
I love
is,
pop
this...
culture, but I don't know who this guy I'm not into the YouTube stars.
Yeah,
I don't know
YouTube.
Anything about the
well,
YouTube
the great
stars.
Part is he actually had people sign a waiver as they enter the party. So he certainly
That's
thought
never a
of
good
this
thing.
In advance. And had security there, but apparently none of that worked out.
He had malice aforethought, clearly.
Oh.
I would love to know how all the drinks were spiked. Was it like, I'm picturing a situation where it's like jungle juice and like it was already pre-made and the drugs were in there and then they're just dispersing
it's
it out.
Yeah, it's a punch bowl.
It's like an 80s, like an 80s,
I don't know how.
Cups are already filled. Just grab one and go.
Right?
That's at the party.
I mean, who knows? This is another one where it's like, okay, sure, that could have happened, or people just could have been doing drugs on their own and gotten incredibly messed up by themselves.
Yeah.
It's hard to say.
Or both.
You never know.
And likely, since it was a YouTuber star, chances of it ending up on
exactly.
YouTube and then
yes.
another legal suit coming out of that
right.
probably would have been.
That's why he went with the waiver.
Have you scoured right. the YouTube? Have you scoured the YouTube yet, Rich?
Not
to see if you can find
stories. No.
The YouTube.
By the way,
Facebook.
Just to say it from just to get legal for a second, you cannot, you know, get people to waive criminal activity. That can't happen. You can't have people sign a waiver that says I allow you to drug me. Just so we're
right. along with,
just so we're all clear.
I would love to know what's in the waiver, though.
Yeah,
just
along
that they can't take pictures or videos of anything that's going on.
So our listeners are learning a lot, not just about standing, but about waivers.
That's
too.
Right. Was this the guy who was involved with the Japanese suicide?
That was his
forced?
Brother.
Ah,
he was.
Boy, you're really
you
up
really
on current
are
events.
A fan.
Yeah.
My goodness,
gotta have your toes in every little pool. So that was his brother. But they've had some disassociation throughout the years. So now he's
troubled
kind of
family.
His own thing. Yeah,
troubled,
coming into his own.
Mm-hmm.
Always be aware of what you're drinking, though. I mean, I wouldn't. I in college. Jungle juice is okay, but I mean, come on. I mean, you should know. Do you really want to go up to an untapped garbage can and stick your... There's like a sandal
Not
floating in
2019,
in it.
You know.
No, kids are too crazy these days. Yep. New York Knicks owner James Dolan.
Get off my lawn.
Another lawsuit, this one involving James Dolan.
Wow, the Knicks.
Dolan owns the Knicks and has been, over the years, subject of the revision? No, revile. Revile?
Revered?
No.
What are you trying to say?
Yeah,
well,
I don't know. I don't know
Knicks
what you're getting at.
Knicks fans hate James Dolan. He's screwed up the Knicks, and he, in this case, is being sued because he took $75.6 million in salary over the last 3 years, and this lawsuit alleges that that is excessive and far from fair.
Resent?
Resent, maybe.
They resent him.
Yes, they do resent him. Compared to the $17 million average of other CEOs, the highest paid CEO among the group that owns the Knicks, besides Dolan, earned less than half of what he did. The Knicks are saying that he actually only earned $1 million, that the additional $74 million was a one-time bonus for performance. But this brings to sort of the bigger picture with Dolan is that, again, people hate him. Knicks fans think he has ruined the franchise. And it's not that, you know, we see shareholder lawsuits like this. A similar story came out with the Disney granddaughter, who's now alleging that Bob Iger, who owns Disney, is earning an obscene amount of money, while the rank and file people who are working at Disney are barely making, you know, enough to eat. So, Sam, Knicks story. What do you think? Are the Knicks gonna sign Melo and Kyrie? And
they sign Melo, they'd be in trouble. You mean Kevin Durant?
I mean Durant, sorry.
Kevin Durant, who got hurt the other night, by the way, and could miss the rest of the postseason.
Yeah.
The Knicks have been a mess
Is it Dolan's fault?
Yes, it's all his fault.
Yeah.
Do you remember when they banned Charles Oakley from Madison Square Garden?
Yes.
Because he got into a tiff. So Charles Oakley used to play for the Knicks, and he was booing James Dolan. James Dolan had his security team come over to Charles Oakley and ban him from the arena. Mm-hmm. That's how soft and how sensitive he is.
Forever?
He can't come back. He is banned from Madison Square Garden. And he is on the list of most popular. He was one of the bad boy Knicks. But this team has been a mess, Bennett. I mean, if you follow the NBA, they've been a mess since the mid-90s.
Yeah, this is just, I think, a shareholder cop-out saying, hey, guys, this is our opportunity. Let's change the King's Court and let's clean house. So, but if, you know, yeah, you can work hard and you can, you know, have this job here, do my obligations over here and work all these, you know, responsibilities. But it seemed a little excessive, the amount of time that he was spending with his band. As a shareholder, I would be concerned, but I don't know if that'd be to the point of, you know, backing of a lawsuit.
Yeah. His band performed 50 times in 6 countries and 41 U.S. cities, according to the lawsuit in 2017, instead of, you know, earning that big salary running the Knicks.
Yeah.
These are first world problems.
Yeah.
I was thinking the same thing.
Same thing.
You know, we have talked about a lot on this show today, and these are really first world problems considering some of the other topics we've had.
Far more important
is people.
I was going to say, how do we segue to this one?
Because this is the most important.
If that is a first world problem, I was going to introduce it this way. Some like males, some like females. Others like animals, I guess.
But wait, these were females.
Animals.
Yeah. Tina, this is all you.
Super strange.
Okay,
in bestiality news,
yeah,
Tina Martini.
I mean, really, that's the only word we need to say is bestiality. I mean, these are bad guys doing bad things to innocent animals who have gotten 40, who will probably spend up to 41 years in prison.
Good.
So, yeah, good.
I mean, it is disgusting, and I just feel terrible for the animals.
What are we talking about exactly, Tina? Could you explain for our listeners?
You're going to make Tina say
okay.
it?
Yeah. Everybody take your phones out and
draw it on this piece of paper.
Look up what bestiality is. That's what we're talking about.
So what? Forcing themselves, these three individuals,
yes,
ranging in age from 31 to 41.
And here's the count. 9 horses, a cow, a goat, and dogs.
No, but wait a second.
These are
an unspecified number
individuals.
Of dogs.
Right. The questionable amount of other animals.
There could be a lot of dogs out there that are unaccounted for that they had sex with.
Unspecified number, according to the article.
Yeah, there's a boy who they gave the job of I guess.
That's the most concerning to me.
He was the wingman of this group to get the animals
the wing,
in.
The wingman?
that's what his role was in this bizarre group. But the article does say that the animals, the horses at least, were all females.
It doesn't matter. They were being abused.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel terrible for the animals.
It's sick.
And these guys are sick, and bad people deserve to go to jail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you've heard the weirdest legal story on our show.
Okay. And do we really want to get into who suggested we do this?
Sam? I have one guess.
Bob Coyne?
Question is, do these guys not have lives?
No, Jason Whiteside called in and said he wanted us to cover this.
Hey,
no surprise.
It's our duty to our listeners to cover stories across the legal spectrum here on Legal Face-Off, mm-hmm, including the bestiality story.
What's a proper punishment, Rich? How should they be punished?
Lindsay, you had some thoughts.
Oh, I mean,
you like how he just throws you on
yeah.
the spot?
Yeah, like put me on the spot. That's okay. I can take it. You know, I.
No, the punishment is 20 to 41 clearly, years in jail.
Clearly, they should be in jail for some amount of time. Do I think it's 41 years? I don't know. I mean, I think they need to go to jail for something. They need to be taught a lesson. I don't understand why any individual would do this unless they have some sort of mental illness.
Yeah.
I think that they probably should go to some sort of mental institution rather than jail, because there's obviously something wrong
no
with
pets.
These people.
Just no pets at the institution.
I just don't understand it. It's mind-boggling.
Yeah. Crazy.
I just figure, why don't you just put like a bunch of dogs who haven't eaten in like a week in a pit, and then you drop these guys in there.
Mm-hmm. Bennett, that actually sounds not a bad idea.
You, yeah. can, you know, you can monetize it.
Yeah, these guys
you've been awful silent over this guy.
This one, I was awestruck by it. I was like, okay, I see the first six, and then this one pops up. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, they're clearly a sexual risk to society in a lot of ways. And if they're willing to do this, who knows what they'd be willing
well,
to do.
Well, I'd be worried about children.
Right. Exactly.
I mean,
that's what you were getting.
Yeah. Yes,
that's,
yeah.
What
I'd be worried about anybody.
So 20
Seriously.
To 41 seems right.
Well, hard to segue out of the bestiality story, Sam, but that's your job. That's what you
that
get paid.
Yeah, Sam, that's why you get paid the big bucks, Sam.
What would Casey Kasem say?
You're Casey Kasem. I'm yes, not Casey Kasem.
True.
Casey Lindsay Kasem, Strom, top 40.
There you
and
go.
And Bennett Wakenight, thanks for coming into the studio.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Next time we'll find much sicker stories to discuss.
Looking forward to it.
For Rich and Tina, my name is Sam. Thanks to Ben Anderson, per usual. We'll talk to you next time here on Legal Face Off.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab, so hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this, nah. Courtroom combat going hand to hand.